Hey guys, before we get going with this podcast, I wanted to ask for your help. So every year we do a golf charity tournament to raise funds for Homes for Our Troops. They're a charitable organization that builds adaptive homes for wounded vets. It's an awesome cause, and we decided, being that they're building homes and we're in the real estate space, why not bring the community together for a day of fun and raise some money for this awesome organization. The event is September 22nd. You can either join a team or bring your own team. You got to sign up now. We have sign-ups going on until, I think, like the beginning of September. It's on blacksheepopen.com. If you don't play golf, you can always volunteer. For anybody that attends, there's going to be food, drinks, prizes. There's a $10,000 prize. There's a lot of giveaways, and a lot of sponsors are going to be there giving away a lot of swag and cool gifts. So definitely a fun day. It's a great cause. So please help me spread the word. And if you can join us, come on by September 22nd, blacksheepopen.com. That's where you can go to sign up. And if you have any questions or anything, reach out to me. Thanks guys, and enjoy the show. Welcome everybody to another episode of an Investor's Journey podcast, your home to the no bullshit zone of real estate investing. Here you're going to learn the truth about investing, the good and the bad, as well as strategies that we implement on a daily basis as we run our business. When we started the podcast, one of my pet peeves was interviews. I always feel like people interview people that are selling crap. It's never anything useful. It's never anything that you can actually implement. It's just somebody bragging about their life. So I always said that we would never interview anybody. But like I said, we want to bring you information that is relevant to what it is that we're doing and from real, actual experienced investors. So we have with us right now a very short individual. Friend of ours and a investor for a while, and he is a person that I'm very impressed by. I'm very impressed with his mentality, with the way he manages his finances, personal and business wise. And he's a very successful investor and a full-time pilot. So we're also joined by the smarter half of Prime Homes, Mr. John Barr. Mr. Andrew Middlestadt, to give a nice little introduction, brought us a bottle of Irish whiskey. So this interview might get interesting halfway through, because we're already halfway through the bottle. So I hope you guys enjoy it, and let's move on with the interview. So welcome, Mr. Andrew Middlestadt.
Hi, how you doing, guys? Thanks for having me on.
It's a pleasure having you, sir. Now, introduce yourself. What do you do for a living?
So full-time, I'm an airline pilot. I've been flying now for about 8 years. And I guess some of the perks of the job are being able to bring some establishments or some embellishments.
Trot around the world and bring back the finest spirits from the finest places.
Yes, exactly. So I have a passion for flying. I absolutely love doing it. I've been doing it professionally now, like I said, for about 8 years now. I fly for one of the larger airlines in the world. I get to see a lot of the planet. And anyway, for as much flying as fun is, much fun as flying is, rather, always had a passion to start a business. And with bouncing around the world, although it is a huge benefit and a perk and it's been a lot of fun, it's really hard to run a traditional business, I guess, which is where the interest for real estate started. So anyway, just started from ground zero, didn't know anybody or anything involved in real estate. And just like you guys, started from the ground up. And it's been a fun journey, and I really enjoyed it.
So out of everything out there, why real estate?
Because of the passive returns and the ability to offset some of the piloting income that both my wife and I have. So being able to run a business from the road and being able to grow it and scale it and not have to be in a specific location all day, every day to be able to grow it. It just seemed like a fascinating concept to me. And it just was something I decided to run with.
And how long have you been doing this?
I bought my first property back in 2013, okay. Down the southwest side of San Antonio. Did everything possible wrong. personally was not in a good financial spot. I had to borrow some money for the down payment on that property. Wasn't dead up to my eyeballs from school. Basically, just didn't have the money to start and run a business. So we got ourselves into that property. It was the one and only property I've ever lost money on. I think we lost about $600 or $700 over the course of a year after selling it. So it was a great learning experience. And from that point, just hit the pause button for about 5 years. About 3.5 years. And just really got a good personal financial foundation, which to me is super important to anyone who's either experienced or just starting out. You need to have a good respect and ability to handle your finances personally before you can do it in a business, which is exactly what this is. Exactly. You know, you hear people talk about rental homes here and there. It really is a business. You have to run it as one. So you need to learn how to operate and work with money and respect it yourself before you can bring it into the marketplace.
Yeah, it's very true. And I mean, like yourself, John is a person that he's all about finances. He's all about the numbers. And we all actually started reading the same book recently, and it's all about money. It's about investing, about managing your finances. And it's one thing that we see time and time again, that people don't look at their personal finances before they do anything else. And you got to understand where your expenses are, where your money's going. And if you don't understand that, you're never going to be able to invest. You're never going to be able to be profitable, because you don't even know what profit looks like. Exactly. I mean, you don't know. When we speak to certain people that are investing in real estate, and they can't even tell us their expenses or even if they're cash flow positive, because they don't know how to run their numbers. I mean, that's how you get into a lot of trouble in this industry.
Yeah, and that's something I always say a lot to people, or just talking personal finance. Like, if you can't even control a budget of saying, do you know where every dollar in your bank account comes from and goes to every single month, credit cards and everything? It's like, if you can't even do the basic thing of that, investing is a long ways away from what you should be trying to focus on. Yes, everyone needs to make money, but trust me, if you understand how money comes in, works through your bank, and goes out to credit cards, it's going to be a lot better off further down the road. That's something that I learned it the hard way. Twice I learned it the hard way. I don't know how you guys can attest to that, but it's something that I learned through the fires of how to manage finance, because I didn't know how to manage it and realized, like, this is no way to go. And then I wanted to further myself. So once you understand how those basic things work in your personal finances, business and investing become a lot easier.
And it's a foundational trait that I think is very, very frequently overlooked in this business. You know, there's so many seminars and people out there teaching you how to get $0 out of pocket into your properties. And there's a time and a place for that. There's absolutely a way that, you know, that's the benefit of real estate, is to not have to put any money in them out of your own pocket. But with that being said, if you don't have a good understanding of where, like John said, where your dollars are going to, you're going to be in trouble. And that's what I got in trouble with my first property too, was I realized that as I was trying to operate this as a business over the course of a year, I didn't want to stick a single dollar into it because I didn't have a dollar to put into it. Right. And at that point in time, it's like, all right, take a step back. Let's start over. Let's get a good foundation here. Let's learn, you know, I'm married, so I had to learn how to work with my wife to be able to work out all these issues and pay off all of our debt. And I'll tell you what, on the backside of that, even though it took a couple of years and we missed some really good investing years in the, you know, 2013, 2014, we probably could have made, you know, bought a lot more properties. But to be able to have that ability going into the future, that it just makes it a heck of a lot easier when you go to, when you walk into a bank and you say, hey, I've got no debt. And, you know, except for my properties. And man, they're just, it's so much easier to work with on the back end as well. So there's a lot of benefits.
Yeah. And that's really the reason why I wanted to have you here, is because I mean, and this is something that I try to tell a lot of people when I meet them, is what are your goals in real estate? And a lot of people always say is to own rental properties, and they have a good job. So I'm like, don't leave your job if you have a good job and you want to own rental properties. Like, everybody wants to be, they think that, you know, they get sold the dream from gurus or these TV shows that you want to be a real estate investor, a real estate professional. You got to quit your job, go all in. And they don't understand that once you quit your job, your credit goes out the window, your financeability goes out the window, and you're a person that you have your full-time job. And how many rentals do you currently own or investment properties?
So right now we're in the process of selling off some properties. So right now we've got three. We've done about a dozen deals or so in the last 18 months or so. So it's just, you know, it's taken a little more time than a part-time job.
But you've done a dozen deals in the past 18 months while having a full-time job.
Yes.
So, and your wife, both full-time employees.
Exactly. And that's the whole point, right? Is that it's doable having a full-time job, where a lot of people think that I got to quit my job. And I'm like, you're shooting yourself in the foot by doing this. Like, one of the hardest things that John and I have had to face is being a business owner. Nobody wants to lend to us. You know, no banks want to lend to us. They don't.
At any kind of favorable rate. There are people that will lend to you. There will be people that will lend to you at like 15% interest rate and points, but that's no kind of way to carry any kind of long-term property.
And we were laughing about this just the other day because we were talking about like how, like, it's no wonder. I mean, our bank account swings from like 30 grand to 200 grand, back to 50 grand, back to 250, and it's just... That up and down, the banks look at it and they're like, holy crap, that is...
They're sweating it out.
Yeah, they're like, no. And then one thing I always say, like, but we never go negative. You know, but they don't care about those things. But so what are your goals, your personal goals with real estate? Like, what's your, you know, that you said that you wanted to do this as a business and all that. Like, what's your ultimate goal in real estate?
So it started off as the challenge, and to this day it still is, to be completely honest with you. The other part of it is, while going through and taking a pause from all this and focusing so hard on paying off all these debts, cars, credit cards, we really had to sit down and focus and prioritize, okay, what's important to us, where do we want to be, and how do we want to spend our time? Because when you don't have any money to do stuff, you have to figure that out. So what we did is we figured out what's important, and we liked spending as much time as possible with family and friends, and we enjoy traveling on our personal time.
Yeah.
On top of doing it for the paycheck, yes, which isn't bad. But anyway, so we want to be able to do that, and we both at times are gone up to 18 days a month for work. And although it's been a dream come true, I love it. I would love to peel that back to about half as much, about 9 days a month for flying. And that's possible, but you're going to take a pay reduction.
Right.
So anyway, we wanted to be able to supplement the income. Last year, we took two leaves of absence from work, one in the month of February and one for about 3 weeks in November, and just went traveling. And we were able to do that because we had a financial goal in mind. We learned how to save. And we had money coming in for properties.
Right.
And last year was a really heavy travel year. We went and saw all seven continents, and about half of that was paid for by real estate. So,
nice.
You know, it's just some pretty powerful stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, and especially when you look at the time frame, because that's one thing that, you know, one thing that we've learned from the book that we started reading is that it's not timing the market, but it's time in the market, right?
Yep.
So you said that you think that you lost possible opportunities back in 2013 and 14. Of course, we were going through a bull trend, but you're still making money right now. And that's one thing that I always tell people is that don't have that fear of missing out. Like, real estate is always going to be real estate. People are always going to need a roof over their head, and there's always going to be a deal to be done.
I want to make it clear. You weren't flipping houses. These were funded buy and holding properties for whether it be a year or more, but it was buying, refinancing, holding, and then selling at a later time.
Exactly. You know, flipping can be difficult with a full-time job, even if you're in town every single day. So these are, yes, long-term buy and hold. We're going to hold them at least for a year. If some of them we plan on holding for much, much longer.
Right. Very good. Very good. So that being said, what John just mentioned is we wanted to lead kind of into that whole financing side of picking up a rental, right? While we've done a lot of deals ourselves, we've never fully gone through the process of, you know, the whole financing side.
Refinancing to a traditional mortgage that most people would
right.
get. And we can refinance to them, but they're like at 8-9%, and it makes it very hard to hold for a cash flow perspective at that kind of interest rate.
Yep.
You've never been able to refinance through a traditional Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac backed style mortgage where you have.
Yep.
That's so where your properties are. You got.
Keeping all that in mind, right? Your financing and everything. Like, when you start off with the property, what is it that you look at to analyze them? Do you look at cash flow, equity, future appreciation? I mean, what is it that you're looking at when you analyze a property?
So Personally, I'm looking for a good combination of both cash flow and equity. Appreciation is just a bonus to me. All the tax write-offs and stuff, just a bonus. But I'm looking at these to possibly hold on to for a year or two, cash flow them, and then sell them and turn it into something bigger. You know, turn one house, sell it a year or two down the road, turn it into two houses, and eventually, or possibly even something bigger, you know, commercial, multifamily, right, something of that sort. So that's what I'm looking for. I want to see a percentage return on cash on cash above what the market can give me, what an equity or some sort of index fund can give me.
Explain cash on cash a little bit of like what that exactly is. Not in the full details of it, but what does basic cash on cash really mean?
So I want to...
Cash on cash return is the term we're talking about.
So I want to take a look and see the amount of cash flow that I'm going to make in a year on the property divided by the amount of money that I put into the property.
So if you cash flow $2,000 a month or $2,000 over the year net and you put $10,000 down, that's a 20% cash on cash return.
Yes.
Okay. So you say you want to get a higher return than what you can get in the market where they say the average is 8 to 10, but you say you want higher than that in real estate and you're able to get 20 with... The down payment you put down to $2,000 back.
So I'm looking to get between 20 and 30 on cash on cash return, simply because that way there's a little bit of wiggle room if, you know, the appraisal doesn't come back as well and your cash on or your amount invested is a little bit higher or it doesn't rent for as much as what you think. That's a very conservative outlook. You know, that way I'm happy if something goes wrong and I'm still getting 15 to 20% cash on cash per year, I'm still happy with that. And that I don't include the equity in that anywhere. I want to see probably at least $10,000 to $15,000 equity in the property.
What is that percentage wise?
At the end, we're buying anywhere from $130,000 to $160,000 properties in the San Antonio area. So it's just under 10%. That's the bare minimum. Mm-hmm. And that's with a lot of contingencies and stuff built in. You know, we estimate up costs on the rehab. We estimate up costs on just all across the board to be able to make sure that way, if we do have to fire sale the property for some reason, we can still sell it and not be losing any money.
So what kind of repairs are your like limit that you are going to be willing to do? That you say, if it has more than this, we just can't handle it, you know?
Yeah, so we've kind of found some comfort in about 1990s homes or newer. This is your typical KB builds, and this is just totally personal. I know there's a lot of different homes you can buy in San Antonio. That's just a comfort level for us. A lot of them won't have the major infrastructural problems that the older homes will. Yeah. We've had, just like you guys have, we've had foundation issues and other stuff. But a lot of the properties tend to be built more to a modern code. So you have that going for you.
You don't have to mess with the aluminum wiring, the shady plumbing and foundations that you get.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Questionable.
And they tend to be more in the further out suburbs. And that's just kind of the part of town that that we like dealing with. No reason other than it's just we found a comfort zone there.
And so is it more based on numbers or location as far as that goes?
We will look more... We'll start in certain parts of town, and we'll go and talk to different realtors, wholesalers, and do marketing and stuff in different parts of town based upon those criteria. Not saying we wouldn't do it if it came our way, but you know, just doing this part time, we're able to be a little more picky on the properties that we do want to take part in, because we can say no. We still have the income coming in from a day job, and we can move on to the next deal that we're comfortable with.
Right. So you, and that's very important because, I mean, again, the amount of deals that you guys have done in less than 2 years and while having a full-time job and being able to pick and choose your deals is what I try to tell people is that, you know, don't be so eager to rush into a deal because there's always one that's going to meet your criteria if you're willing to have the patience.
Yeah. So, and there's a few properties that we probably could have gotten into that would have been over our heads. And within a few weeks afterwards, we're getting into something that was more cookie cutter for us.
So getting in over your head kind of takes me to a question that a lot of people have is that how is it that you
So you have, let's say you deal with wholesalers or realtors, right? They bring you a property. Do you take their word for it, or do you do your own analysis on these deals?
Both. I mean, we try to surround ourselves with good, good quality people,
right?
So that you're not having to second guess yourself whenever a deal comes in. So I'll really take what they have to say to heart. I try to get to know them personally and professionally before we will, you know, do any business with them. But with that being said, yeah, we'll dive into our own numbers. I'll go out there. I'm not going to take anyone's rehab number for gospel by any means. Go out there, do our own analysis, bring our own contractors out there, take a look, try to get some sort of back when we started. I didn't have any MLS access, so I'd have to go and find a third party who could help me out with that.
Right.
But yeah, no, so a little bit of both. You know, you just need to do business with good people that you're going to enjoy doing business with. And of course, trust but verify, right?
Yeah, for sure. And you learned all these things, analyzing the deals and all this through some guru training or just putting in time, analyzing a bunch of deals, seeing what makes sense.
Yeah, so we started with a local course here in San Antonio for about a year. Really learned a lot of good foundational stuff. And if anything, they gave us the confidence to be able to go out and do the first deal. But past that, I mean, once you learn how to do this, you can look at a deal and understand the different inputs to create the output that you want.
Right.
So, yeah.
It's been a mixture of experience and educating yourself. And
I think just putting yourself in an environment with people who are doing what you want to do and being successful at it and doing so in a way that you want to duplicate, I think that's more important than anything. You don't need to pay a guru for that. I mean, you can if you want to. But
well, like you said, there's nothing wrong with gurus, but just know what you're paying for. It's not going to be the one step that all you need to know and you're going to be a millionaire just by talking to that guru. It's like, it's going to get you, like you said, foundational education, give you the confidence to know what you're looking for to go out and at least do it. But going out there and doing it is like that. The guru is just step one out of a 10-step program.
Exactly.
There's no 3-step program to be a millionaire like the guru sell it. But it's like that's step one, but you need to surround yourself with people that you know and trust and verify and work your way through. Like I said, you need to put yourself in the positions to learn these experiences.
Yep.
So, I mean, I agree with that 1,000%. When I started in, I mean, everything I do is whenever I want to do something, I surround myself by those people that are doing it. Because, I mean, I'm very lazy. So I'm not going to study anything. I'm not going to go through any guru programs. I don't have the patience for that. I want to just hit the road running and learn as I go. So the best way I've done that is by partnering with people, by getting to know people that are in the industry, killing it, doing a good job or doing at least the job that I want to be doing and just surrounding myself by them and just stuff just rubs off. I mean,
and a lot of times the differentiator, whether you go to a guru course or whether you just do it yourself, the biggest differentiator is the people that just go out and do it.
Yep.
Gosh, I mean, you know, who we're going to be in a year from now is one step, there's one foot in front of the other, what we do day by day between now and then. So just taking those small steps to actually going and doing it is the biggest obstacle. So,
I mean, I always looked at it. I've met a lot of people that are so much smarter than me in any aspect of real estate. I mean, they know their shit from start to finish, but I'm still doing better than they are because while they may know more, I'm doing more.
Yep.
You know, so, and while I do fuck up and we've screwed up and all of that, we're still doing better than everybody else. It's just knowledge and no action. So, I mean, that the fact that you've taken that action and that you've done what you've done in such a short period of time while having a full-time job, I mean, it's, again, very impressive.
That's doing.
Yes, it's just doing and learning, and you're gonna fuck it up and you're gonna lose money. But I mean, it's what else you got, right? I mean,
it's how you get experience.
Yeah. So, going into it a little further, like, how do you finance your properties? Because this is gonna lead into that, the kind of like the BRRRR strategy. I'm sure you've heard of it, you know, buy, rehab, rent, refinance, repeat. So when you're buying and then when you're refinancing. So when you're buying the property, how are you buying it? How are you financing these properties?
So at the beginning of last year, we bought our first property again after that hiatus, February of last year of 2017. And in January, we were kind of putting a strategy together. We felt like we were ready to go, jump back into the market, had cash, had contacts, had the time and the knowledge and the ability to go into it. So we just called a couple of friends that we went to college with and asked if they'd be interested in lending us the money to be a private money lender. We had contacts with Hard Money, but we thought that we could do business with someone that we trusted, help them out, and also be able to save on our costs as well. So we found some friends that were business owners up in rural Wisconsin, and they had some cash that they were more than happy to put up with us. So we went to a lawyer and we drew up some documents, and they ended up lending us the money for about the first half year that we were doing this.
Very nice.
So they would lend us 80% of the, not even the appraiser, just the value that we thought it was going to appraise for. They didn't require an appraisal of us, nothing.
So you chose the route of like, I want to build a relationship with somebody and actually benefit somebody else versus just going hard money route with the company that has fees and stuff like that. Because that's one thing we say, it's like, I want to build a relationship with people, not relationship with a company. Because the company is like, they got their fee structures, they're out for themselves, they're looking out for themselves, where you're more apt to know a person and say like, hey, I want to build a relationship with you. And that's going to work out longer. And over the long term, I feel that's going to work out better than just going with a company because you get 1 point less. Ooh, you're still at 2 points.
And that's a benefit of doing this part-time for fun, I guess, is because you can do that kind of stuff. This just so happened to be the best value on money that we could find. Anyway, so they lent the money to us, and we gave them a first lien on the property. So if anything were to happen, and the first one we bought was a very light rehab. We actually bought it's the one that we bought from you guys. Y'all were wholesaling it. And light rehab, I think we put just shy of $4,000 into it. Okay. So I was able to, I put together like a little bid package for them. It had, it's an Excel spreadsheet. It had the address, what the work we were going to do, what we were buying it for, how much rehab we were going to need, what I thought it was going to appraise for, and put a link in there to some pictures on Google Drive and emailed it over to him. I said, hey, here's the basics. If you want any more, we can talk about it over the phone. But I just wanted them to feel comfortable from the very beginning of the process as well. So they were comfortable. You know, it just needed some light work on the inside and some fence work on the outside. And so it was a good property for them to jump into as their first time being private money lenders.
This is only your second property.
This is yeah. Luckily, they had a lot of faith in us.
Yeah, well, but I mean, one thing that I'm noticing that you're saying, and this is when I speak to some wholesalers that want to get into flipping and they have problem raising money. You put a bid package, you put the numbers together, you showed them what everything is. And when I talk to so many of these people that they're struggling with trying to find private money, they don't know their numbers. And like I tell them, I'm like, if you're going after somebody else's money, you got to bring them numbers. I mean, they're taking all the risk at this point, right?
You got to show them that you understand what it is that you're doing. And also, I put in there how much I need to borrow from them and what their return on investment would be. You know, hey, guys, I think you're going to have your money back in 45 days based on these factors. And just to give them a general idea. So, yeah, that shows to them that your understanding of the property, of the process, and of everything in between. And having that faith and displaying that knowledge is really important to a private money lender.
Let's take that property a little further, right? So you said 45 days. Did you build a cushion in there? Where did the 45 days come from?
So the 45 days was about 2 days worth of rehab, and then a week or two of buffer time in there, and then a 30-day refinance period into a 30-year Fannie Mae backed loan.
Okay, and so you went, prior to buying the property, you had already been pre-qualified?
Yeah, so we went in, and during this process, in the months before we jumped into buying this property, we went out, we built relationships with contractors again. We went out and found a couple of lenders that we were happy with, both private money and long-term financing. And we kind of had that process started. Yeah.
How did you determine your long-term, your traditional lenders?
It was based on relationships, first of all, of other lenders that friends had used. And eventually we expanded it out and realized that there are some really good companies out there that can write loans in many states or all 50 states or wherever. You can find them online, do your research on them, and they have a lot less fees, points, better rates, that such.
What do you do, Google refinance?
Yeah, so actually we just started on Zillow. We went to Zillow Mortgages and nice. found companies that had at least 100 reviews and were 4.5 stars or higher. So that way they had a backing, they had a lot of people that were obviously happy with their product. And just kind of started from there and just took an afternoon and called around and talked to them and figured out what their fee structure was, what their costs were, what their rates were, how they could help us out, what we were doing. Can they even do a rate and term refinance out of a private money loan? So now,
how did you know what questions to ask? Like, how did, like, if somebody was listening and says, I don't even know what questions to even ask. So, like, it's obviously you call around enough of them and you figure it out. But, like, what questions? Because, like, with a mortgage, there's hidden fees and structures and stuff all over the place that can seem really good up front, great marketing, lots of money spent on marketing, and they say, oh, no money down, but you're going to pay all this stuff at the end. Like, how did you learn or work at somebody go to, like, figure out what to ask somebody?
Well, to be honest, deal number one where I told you we did everything wrong, I didn't ask those questions. I didn't know to ask those questions. But after being fairly unhappy with all the fees that we had, just by doing it wrong, we figured out how to get better going forward.
Yeah.
So, and that's where it comes when you build relationships with people, other investors who are doing what it is that you want to do. It becomes a really easy phone call or text and say, hey, who have you used and why? That's a very important and powerful question.
So back to relationships. There we go.
Well, and that's, I mean, that's one thing that I guess if you guys have been listening to this podcast at all, one thing that we beat to death is your network, right? I mean, it's your relationships. It's who you know, and not so much trying to be a one-man team, a one-man army, because you're not going to do it on your own. I mean, it's having those relationships, like you said, knowing the right people. Even when you buy from wholesalers, you want to be able to hang out with them. You want to be able to get to know them, you know, because it's serious things. You're using other people's money. You're putting your own credit on the line. I mean, this is something that could really hurt you if you don't put in the time, right?
Okay. Yeah, it's not just I gave you my business card, you gave me mine, and all of a sudden we're best friends now. All of a sudden we're in our network. Like, it's they're friendships, you know? They build over the course of time, and they really become enjoyable, both personally and professionally.
And especially in real estate now. I mean, real estate being as hot as it is, I mean, we get pitched all the time from hard money lenders, from title companies, from attorneys, continuously.
Wholesalers.
Wholesalers.
I got a deal for you.
No, nobody ever cares to sit down and build a relationship. You know, I mean, that's the thing that, like, there's a million of everybody out there right now. The market is crazy hot. Hard money lenders are everywhere. But, hey, I lend money. Here are my terms. Do you want money? You have a deal? Do you want money? Do you have a deal? I'm like, relax. You know, like, okay, I want to get to know you. Like, who am I doing business with here? You know, is it just a salesman? Is it a company? And they don't take the time to do that. That's why they never gain our business. And the people that have gained our business, they've had it. And we recommend those people to everybody that we work with, right?
Certainly.
So, I mean, relationships, network, it's really the foundation and the way that you even operate in the real estate industry.
Yeah. So to go back to your original question, we just did it wrong the first time. And because you can learn a lot from either yourself doing things wrong or someone else doing something wrong and learn from those mistakes. So I went through, I sat down with the settlement statement or the HUD, whatever it was, the CD back then. And I went through and, okay, they charged me this fee. This was $300. This was $600. And all these fees added up. And I sat down with that and I highlighted them and I called these different companies and said, what do you charge for this? What do you charge for this? And obviously, it's not all about the cost of the loan origination. It's about the person you're working with. Can they actually see this loan through as well? But heck, when you're doing a nationwide search for someone who can provide a good quality product, you're going to find someone.
Like, looking up in the back end, because it's not about finding the cheapest product. Because, like, we all know going to the cheapest person is usually not going to give you the best product by any means. But if you're somewhat knowledgeable and do the research, 4.5 stars, at least 100 reviews, you're pretty confident at least they've pleased somebody and they have a good cost structure associated with that. So then they're confident to move forward.
Certainly.
I mean, the reason for asking all that was I meet a lot of people that they say, you know, well, I can't do this because my bank won't finance it. And I'm like, Okay. Why not go to another bank?
I don't have a bank.
Well, that's what I'm saying, right? So it's like people think that they got to use their own bank, the ones that they cash their checks with, and they don't understand that in real estate, no. Like anything goes, shop around. Find a bank that's in, what, Ohio? You know, wherever the hell the bank is that's going to give you the best terms.
Especially now, like they say, oh, I have a relationship with my banker. And they say, okay, ask who's your bank. They're like, oh, it's Chase Bank or Wells Fargo. Relationships with those banks aren't what they used to be 20, 30 years ago. And it's like after the Dodd-Frank and the real estate crash, and like they're heavily, heavily, heavily regulated to where you might have a relationship with that person, but they're still bound by their company and what they can lend because they're federally regulated on what they can and can't do. And based on the classification of bank. If you were banking with the biggest bank, they're the most bound of anybody because they're the financial backbone of the United States. So they're not quite as, well, yes, you have a relationship with them, doesn't mean you can't go somewhere else and try somebody else's product because smaller banks can offer better products. I think you've gone to some smaller banks and they've gotten some much more favorable rates.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Just the other day, in fact, sidetrack here, I went into a Bank of America. I had a check stolen and fraudulently cashed. The check was written from Bank of America. Hope I can use their name here because it was them. They were awful.
I think it's okay.
It was a Bank of America check cashed at a Bank of America, and I was filling out Bank of America fraudulent paperwork, and I went into Bank of America to have them notarize it, and they couldn't do it. Like their flexibility, because I didn't have an account there, their flexibility is zero.
Like, yeah, they fraudulently cashed both deposit and issued a check.
I sat there, I said, you realize how ridiculous this sounds, right? And he's like, I'm sorry, I can't. He's like, Mr. Robot Man, like, no, I can't do this for you. So anyway, yes, the moral of the story is the smaller banks, the smaller relationship-built banks and lenders certainly have a lot more flexibility.
100%. Yeah, and I mean, going back to relationships. So shop around. Don't go just because your bank or one bank or even five banks said no. Doesn't mean that there isn't a bank out there that's going to say yes, you know. So you're borrowing your money. And here's something that we spoke about at last meetup was this gentleman that he was using all cash to buy. He wanted to use all cash to buy his houses. So you spoke to him more. You want to talk about
that? I mean, his ideology wasn't flawed by any means. It's more just he didn't know what you can and can't do. And his thing was like, I want to buy properties and have cash. I'm going to buy them cash and then I'm going to hold them and wait 6 months and then I'm going to refinance them because I then pull all my cash back out. And I really kind of just asked him, I was like, why would you do that? He's like, well, I can move quicker with the cash. And he had a lot of different reasons, which were good, of just saying like, well, I don't have to pay cost on money. I don't have to deal with anybody else. But then I asked him, I was like, but now you have to wait 6 months for your money to come back out. And he says, well, yeah, everyone does. I'm like, no, they don't. If you're paying off an underlying lien because you've gotten some form of hard money, private money, whatever it is, borrow the money, and you're paying off underlying lien, they'll refinance up to 75% of the appraised value in essentially as fast as you can get the loans closed.
And actually, they'll go up to 80 now on the first number of loans. I think it's the first four Fannie Mae loans. They'll go up to 80%.
Really?
Yeah.
That's something new. And he just didn't realize you could even do that. And he's like, man, I didn't realize that. So like, and I asked him, like, so would you pay 10% interest to immediately have your money back out in 2 months to refinance and go find that next deal? And he's like, well, it's kind of still kind of expensive. Like, yeah, but that's four extra months. You can essentially complete three rental properties in the time it took you to refinance one property to get your money back out. So, I mean, that's a huge advantage.
Why did it take 6 months to get his money back out?
That's just the federal regulation. Because if you refinance in under 6 months and you paid cash, they will make you, they will only refinance 80% of what you purchased the property at. So basically, they don't care what it's worth. So if you bought it for $100,000, rehabbed it, made it worth $150,000, and you try to refinance in 3 months, they're going to make you put 80% down of the $100,000 purchase price. Or if you wait 6 months, they will put down 80% of the new $150,000 value. So, but if you have an underlying lien, they will refinance up to 80% of the new appraised value in under 6 months.
So when someone else holds the lien, you're actually doing a rate and term refinance as opposed to a cash out refinance. So they're paying off the original lender. They're giving you a better interest rate. and giving you longer terms.
So the benefit of that refinance opposed to a cash out refinance is better terms.
A lot of times you'll get with a rate and term refinance, you get a better interest rate. Right. Yeah. A lot of times it's not a big difference, but also you can do the refinance much quicker. You know, we've done refinance on this first property I told you about in as little as we started it within a week.
Right. And the reason for all of that is that we get a lot of people that they want to go cash, and that's why we tell them, like, you have a chance to borrow the money at obviously reasonable rates, not, you know, your 4 and 14, whatever hard money lenders are doing now. But at reasonable rates, sometimes it's better to borrow it because you can refinance a lot quicker for a lot higher than doing a cash out refi for a higher interest rate 6 months late, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, that's a major point that he didn't know about, and many people that were in that table didn't know about. And it's just one of those things that you don't know about until you either surround yourself with the right people or you just fucked up and did it. And then you're like, oh, well, there's a better option.
Yeah, mortgage lender goes, why'd you do that? You know, I can refinance you at 80 in less than 6 months. Oh.
Yeah. I mean, there are benefits. If someone else holds the loan, you can still do a cash out refinance. But the point being that someone else needs to hold the underlying first lien to be able to do that.
Right. So, I mean, keep that in mind. The money needs to be lent to you. How it's lent to you, it's a creative way that you can kind of work out. But if you do it that way, you can do it within 6 months and up to 80% now, apparently, with some lenders.
Yeah, I forget if it's 4 or 6 on the 80% and then 75 past there on the Fannie Mae-backed loans, that is.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's really good. So when you do the refinance process, so you bought a property, you calculated your upfront costs, everything, your repairs, your holding costs. Are you calculating your refinance cost? Are you calculating, you know, because it costs money to refinance a property?
Certainly, yeah. We sit down. We've got a spreadsheet that we use that I can type in the numbers, and within about, you know, 3 or 4 minutes, once we find some actual property values, once we get a good rehab number, and now that we've done this a bunch of times, we know what our costs are going to be to refinance with certain lenders. So we can sit down and punch in the numbers, and the spreadsheet, you know, nerd alert, will tell you what your returns are going to be, how much cash you can expect to put in to each
deal.
Yeah, always
returns.
Projected. Yes.
They always
add about 10% on the cost and subtract 10% on the gain.
You shoot for 20 to 30 and not starting at 10 and end up with 3.
Yes. Like, yes, exactly.
And I mean, my biggest reason for asking that question is that I meet a lot of wholesalers and then buyers as well, is that they look at a property, they see cash flow is this, cost is this, X is my return. And I'm like, there's a lot of fees in between from that to X.
It's always going to be less.
Exactly. Yeah, so, yes. And that's one thing. The reason it's important is because when they're buying it, they're telling me already, they're like, oh, so if all this works out, we're making 100 cash flow, 150. I'm like, holy crap, you're setting yourself up to possibly break even, if not be negative, if everything doesn't work perfectly and you didn't even factor in your refinance costs.
There are times when $300 a month is uncomforting. You know, just last week on a property, I had a main sewer line break and also an air conditioner condenser go out in the same property in the same day. Nice. So that if this property is cash flowing more than that, but if it was at $300 a month, boom, that knocked out about, you know, 18 to 19 months worth of cash flow, just like that.
Wiped it out.
Totally unexpectedly. So, yeah. So being conservative is really number a very high priority.
Yeah, I guess. And that's one thing that we try to go over with people a lot. Like, I mean, we have a calculator that we use that John's modified to all the new terms and regulations and everything, and we plug in all the properties. That's why whenever a buyer comes to us, we always ask them, what's your refinance rate? What's your interest rate? What's all of that? Because when we want to wholesale you a property, and we've done this with you, we want to know what your rates are, because we're bringing you the property based on the money that you're going to get, because that's the cash flow that you're going to get. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not based on what, you know, optimistic numbers are right now. We want to know what your realistic numbers are later, so you don't get screwed on the property and come back.
Yeah, certainly.
I mean, that calculator's been... it's been a great help for us. And even still, like John says, and Andrew, you know, add 10, subtract 10. Like, I mean, at the end of the day, when you go through the process And I guess that's the biggest point to cover on this, is that you still need to go through the process. There's no way that you're going to avoid mistakes. There's no way that it's going to work out perfect if it's your first house. I mean, don't be afraid of making mistakes. It's going to happen. People have screwed up. But using these strategies, you're going to hopefully screw up a lot less.
Well, it's the same as, you know, as I do for a day job, flying airplanes. It's all about risk mitigation. How can we reduce the risk of the day-to-day of this to create a safe and successful outcome? And it's no different in real estate. You know, you just build a buffer margin in there. And assuming that something's going to go wrong, how can we trap that and mitigate it and still come out successful on the back end?
Yeah, very nice. So finishing off towards the refinance side, how has that experience been? Like, have you started a property, say, okay, we're going to refinance after X amount of time because we're going to get an appraisal that's going to come in at this price and it's all going to be great. I'm going to get this and this is my cash flow. Has it always worked out perfectly, or have you had some times where the appraisal didn't come in right? You weren't able to refinance.
Are you fishing?
So John is over here laughing because it did happen to a property that we were all working on, but I didn't actually mean that property any other time, but we can cover that one.
I would say for the most part, until recently, we've had really good luck because of those KB style homes that we like to do. Like, every fifth house is the same. You know, the door might be on the other side of the house down the street, but they're exactly the same.
Yep.
So you really know what you're getting into. I mean, again, super conservative. I know that this type of flooring works. I know I can get it for this price. I know that this paint color works. I like this countertop, you know, the whole nine yards. And I can tell based upon just looking through some photos of some comps on the MLS in that neighborhood, I can tell what mine's going to be worth. It's super easy. So, in fact, the first two properties that we did last spring with you guys, the appraisals came back to the dollar exactly where we said that they were going to.
Nice.
And one actually came back a little bit higher. But anyway, you know, which actually improved our returns. Yeah.
That's one, you know, John saying I told you that's a thing that we always talked about with John, and we tell wholesalers, is that leave money on the table. Because, you know, those are things that even though we run our comps and we're really good at running them and everything, you don't know what the hell an appraiser is going to look at, you know? And at the end of the day, what you don't want is a bad taste in the investor's mouth when they say your name, right? So I don't want an investor saying, you know, they told me it was worth 150 and the appraisal came in at 140. Because, I mean, it would kill them, It would destroy their returns. It would be terrible just because you were optimistic and wanted to make extra money on your wholesale. So be realistic, leave money on the table, you know, and later you can have an interview with your investors.
The first one came back exactly. The other ones came back either at or above the other properties that we've done. There's been, let's see, we had one snafu a couple months ago and then one a couple months prior to that where it came back less, but the cash flow was so high on it that we were able to put in the extra money that the appraisal came short and still have phenomenal returns. So anyway, it's not a killer process if the appraisal doesn't come back and you have a margin built in there, but it's not preferable. And if that's the worst case scenario, I'll take that and run every day.
Right. So, I mean, you expect to have some of your money sitting still in the property after you refinance?
Yeah, certainly. You know, a couple years ago, if we hadn't missed out on the early 2010s, we probably could have done more deals with zero money out of pocket. But we're putting anywhere from $8,000 to about $15,000 in each property. Some other ones that we're putting a little more into that are cash flowing a little bit higher, we'll hold on to those. But the plan is with these other ones, or, you know, say we're putting $8,000 or $10,000 into it, making $300 a month, and sell it down the road for I don't know, maybe a $20,000 or $25,000 profit after a year. We're in the process of doing that right now, selling some of those properties, taking those capital gains and placing them elsewhere into other properties.
So are you doing 1031s with those? What are you?
So these were actually, we didn't do a 1031 because we upgraded our personal house, but the other ones that we're going to sell later in the year, we're going to 1031. Nice. And put into some other properties. Yeah.
All right. And just to be clear, what's a 1031?
1031 tax deferred exchange, so you're able to take the gains of property and move it into like kind, and not have to pay capital gains, excuse me, on those on the profit that you made in the original property.
Basically defer your taxes till later down the road.
Till later on.
And if you're smart and you do this strategically, you can defer them pretty much indefinitely.
Almost indefinitely. Yeah.
You could just keep rolling them over.
It's the old Monopoly adage. 4 greenhouses, 1 red hotel.
Exactly.
Yep.
Red hotels, you roll up into an estate.
Yeah, an estate.
Compound
and assisted living facility.
There you go.
So let's cover the one property that didn't appraise. That awesome property it didn't appraise. So all the other ones, like one thing that I've seen that's a very true and guaranteed way of running your numbers is single family homes are easy to comp. They're easy to run your numbers, and you can pretty much say to the letter what your value is going to be on these houses, right? Because it's a neighborhood, all the houses are pretty much the same. But this one was different. It was a multifamily home, right?
Yep. Yep.
So it was open to apparently a lot of interpretation, which to us, I mean, having been in this for a while, it didn't seem like there was much interpretation, but to the appraiser, there was.
Yeah, so sometimes you just don't see eye to eye with the appraiser, right? Your opinion of the value and the market's opinion of the value does not necessarily align with what the appraiser thinks.
Yes.
And, you know, with having them hired by the AMC as a third party after 2008 is great. It's provided a lot of safety and security. But not having any oversight can also cause some difficulties when they come back super low.
So we covered this one on our appraisal podcast a few episodes ago about basically we had three different appraisals from three different appraisers all within what, a month?
Yeah,
gosh. 5 weeks tops.
Yeah, it wasn't much more
than
a month.
And the value went from 158 to 238 to selling at 250. And that first appraisal come back 158 cost a lot of money for the fact that was our refinance appraisal that did not work out. And since it didn't work out, there's extra points, extra penalties, interest, extra costs that went into renovating the property, holding the property, and that was an extra $4,000 to $5,000.
Yeah.
And to the point where that just killed the return to where it's like, just sell it off at that point.
But again, it was a desirable property and in a desirable area. There were some margins built into there. It did a beautiful rehab. And luckily, more out of spite when we listed it.
Yeah, shit.
For what we thought it was going to appraise for. And then also, hey, what do you know? The offers actually started coming in at what we thought it was going to be worth. Luckily with all that being said, we were able to sell it pretty easily. But, I wasn't like this in the very beginning. It was my wife that was kicking me the whole time. She's like, you got to plan for the rainy day. You got to plan for the worst case scenario.
Sure.
And if the worst case scenario actually does happen, and you can get out of it at a profit, like, it's a win every time still.
Yeah, and that's really what we try to tell people, like, why we love real estate. You can do whatever job pleases you, right? Like, you love being a pilot. You love doing that. We have other investors that they love being accountants, attorneys, and they love what they do. But just because you love what you do doesn't mean that you can't protect yourself against, pilots have downtime, right? I mean, you guys, come like 2008 financial crisis. I remember a lot of pilots being out of work.
After 2008, thousands of our pilots got furloughed. And the ones who stayed on property took huge pay cuts.
And I mean, what do you do as a pilot when you get laid off? I mean, what do you guys do? I mean, you a lot of them were working construction where I live.
Yeah, a lot work construction, work the desk at Home Depot. You know, some were fortunate enough to have the business acumen to go and start a business or whatever made them happy. But for many of them, it was just a struggling time. You just do whatever you have to do to make the money to put food on the table for your family.
For sure.
And anyway, that goes back to the goals too, is what happens if that does happen. We want real estate to continually bring in the income, during hard times. And if you do that wisely, even during hard times, you'll still make money.
Yeah. Any other questions you have for Mr. Andrew?
No, that's really it.
All right. So you guys, this was the whole point of this interview, is for you guys to hear how it is from somebody that has a full-time job, is, you know, they do what they love, and they started in real estate in 2013, took a break, started again less than 2 years ago, have done over a dozen deals, and now you're actually ventured off into assisted living facilities, right?
Yeah, so residential care facilities, personal care homes, whatever you want to call them in different parts of the country, is really starting to be a growing niche here in San Antonio. And we've been partnering with businesses that maybe are like you guys, that they can't afford to buy a house, but they've got a great business model.
Right.
So we've been going in and partnering with them and allowing them to run their business out of single family homes that we purchase. We get them on long-term leases, and it's worked out wonderfully. So
yeah, and I mean, and that has been, I think, the reason you even got into that is because you surround yourself with the people that are in the industry you are interested in, right? Because I mean, that opportunity probably would not have come in if you would have just not been in real estate, not been paying attention to anything, you would have never jumped on it.
Yeah, it's just going out and building friendships and relationships right. with the people, and all of a sudden you hear about these things that just catch your ear, and you follow up on them, and I don't know, 9 times out of 10, they turn out to be nothing, but every once in a while, they turn out to be something profound. You know, yeah. Everyone can look back on their investing journey and see that in their past, like, wow, that was really a pivotal moment. At the time, I had absolutely no idea.
Yep.
But just putting yourself out there and doing it.
To quote Steve Jobs, you got to connect the dots looking backward. You can't look
and
forward.
That's actually exactly what I was going to say, is that I think a lot of the issue people have when they get into real estate is they try to connect the dots moving forward, and they say, you know, owning rentals is going to be really slow. It's going to take a long time. I got to flip properties. I got to do this. And they don't understand how quickly it moves once you get into it.
Gosh, you know? Even once you start doing it, you look back on the numbers from the previous years and you're like, wow, I didn't even, in my wildest dreams of planning for this year or whatever my goal was,
right.
You look back and just by doing it, you'll surprise yourself.
You really do. And that's one thing that I tell people, just get started. Don't rush into anything, but get started. Get into it. Start analyzing deals. Even if you don't buy a house, analyze a bunch of properties, because the more you analyze, the more you start learning things, then you start being curious about, like, well, what is this number? What is that number? I don't understand this. You start surrounding yourself by people that know this shit, that know it better than you, that can help guide you.
Here's the thing, is you won't realize it's opportunity when it's in front of you if you don't know that it's an opportunity. So being knowledgeable, understanding of the scenarios, putting yourself in a personal and professional situation to be ready. All of a sudden, when it does enter your life through whatever avenue, you can jump on it because you're like, this is what I have set up for myself. This is what I have defined for myself. This is where I want to be. You're not trying to play catch up once the opportunity presents itself.
Right.
If that makes sense. You're ready to jump upon it when you see it, as opposed to preparing when you see it, because that's just backwards.
Yeah. And I mean, there's a saying that says luck is knowledge and preparation.
Luck is where preparation meets opportunity.
There you go.
Yeah, there we go.
So luck preparation meets opportunity. So, I mean, it's exactly that. I mean, when people say, oh, you're lucky. No, I've been working at this.
Working my ass off.
Yeah, you know, and I put myself in these positions that the opportunities presented themselves and I was able to seize them because I was there, right? So, and I had the knowledge, and knowledge sometimes is not so much what you know, but who you know. I mean, one thing that I've always prided myself in is being resourceful. Like, again, I am not the smartest guy by any means, but I will find them. I know the smart people. I mean, I'll find the smart people. I'll partner with them. I'll give them whatever it takes to get me to that next level, you know, and which is the reason why I partnered with John in the beginning. He's a person that's a lot smarter than I am. He understands this shit a lot better than I do. And it's like we can complement each other very well with our strengths and weaknesses. So, I mean, you know, opportunity and preparation. Right?
And that's pivotal. Knowing what you're good at, what your strengths are, and also knowing once they align with what you enjoy doing, then you just start hitting a niche and start running with it.
And I think setting your goals helps a lot with knowing what to say yes and knowing what to say no to.
Mm-hmm.
Right, a lot of people, they start off in real estate and they don't have any goals, so anything that comes their way they say yes to because you have no goals. And once you start establishing your goals, like what we have done, we say no to a lot of things. And sometimes you think about it and you're like, but that could have made you, it could have made us money, but it's not part of our goals. You know what I mean? So it's not, you know, you got to set your goals because then you can focus on things. And because you said no to one thing, you were able to seize a better opportunity that's taking you closer to your goals.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, what do you see in that? Do you agree with having your goals set?
Yeah, sometimes goals are helpful when you can speak them and be able to write them down and they make sense.
Yeah.
To be able to get to that point, it takes a lot of brainstorming, learning, understanding, reading, communicating with both, if you know, if you're married or with your business partner or with whoever you're doing business with. Once you can properly and clearly define those, that gives you a sense of direction and purpose. And that's where I think goals are the most helpful.
Exactly. I mean, purpose, holy crap, is that the thing that gets you up in the morning, right?
Absolutely.
Shit. But, all right. Really appreciate this. I think the knowledge and the experience that you have, how old are you?
31.
31. Just turned. So that is the one thing that's impressed the hell out of me out of you, is that the discipline that you have at 31, along with your wife, because your wife is another smart person that I wish she would be here right now, because I've spoken to her and holy crap, does she impress the hell out of me with the shit that she knows.
Oh yeah, she's got her shit together. And yeah, she I'm really just the does. Numbers guy. She makes them look pretty, which is okay. The important part.
And how old is she?
Third. Cut that out. She's younger than I am.
So, but
also, can I take this a step back a little ways?
Yeah.
leaving some meat on the bone for what you guys, this kind of all ties together with creating that purpose, is when we're selling these properties, we're finding the market value and we're selling them to people, out-of-state investors who want a turnkey property for, you know, we chop off the realtor fees and we're able to take off a few other fees in the meantime by just going straight to title, and we're able to give the purchaser of that product a turnkey property with anywhere from, you know, $5,000 to $10,000 to $12,000 of equity in it as well. So kind of all ties together as well. So they're happy. They're going to keep coming back. You know, and if they're happy, I'm happy. And it's not like it's costing me anything. You know, I'm giving them $10,000 in equity, but I'm not paying a realtor. Yep. So hey, it's just a win-win for everybody too. So that kind of all ties in together too.
Yeah, and that strategy, I think, it's an awesome exit strategy. We try to do it with the properties even when we're flipping them. If we can sell them beforehand without any realtors involved, all day long.
And there's just use your networks. If you do work a full-time job, there's a lot of pilots that I work with that live in high tax, high cost states that want to invest somewhere like Texas. And those are the people that are buying the properties from us. They're just happier than heck to be getting a turkey property for, you know, $130,000 or $140,000 that's going to rent for $1,300 or $1,400. They're ecstatic.
Oh yeah.
So, and they know that, you know, you guys provide a good product, and if they know that you, whoever's doing it, provides a good product, Why wouldn't they come back? You just make it easy for them. You're up front.
And they tell their friends.
Yes.
And that's really how we've grown it. I mean, we started with private money lending. We never used hard money because of relationships, right? I mean, mm-hmm. we worked on relationships from day one. They tell their friends. Their friends come on. And it's just one thing leads to another. And, I mean, that's easy marketing for you when you do the right thing, mm-hmm. right?
Certainly.
And, I mean, that's an awesome exit strategy. And how do you, so you use your network and your friends to find buyers? Or?
Yeah, well, they just know that we're out buying real estate just through, when you spend 20 hours in the cockpit with someone, they tend to find what you do on your free time. And we'll get texts every once in a while. Hey, you guys got anything for sale? Hey, you got anything coming up? Hey, you need any investment partners? Right. It's not everybody, but you know, it's,
heck,
I sold two houses with two phone calls just a couple months ago. I mean, they're happy, I'm happy. It doesn't get much easier than that, right?
It really doesn't. And that's where I tell people that when they're getting started in real estate, I'm like, the easiest form of marketing is tap into your network first.
Yeah.
Tell everybody what you're doing. You're in real estate. I mean, the other day, it was actually funny. On Friday, we met with a fellow investor, kind of mentor of ours, that we met him at Jim's, and we were having lunch, and the waitress overheard our conversation and everything, and she's like, actually, I'm finishing my property, and I want to put it on the market. Can you guys help? Right? So, I mean, it was something that's, when people know what you do, you know, you become the person that they can call. I mean, they know you, so they're like, I'd rather try with you that I know than go find somebody off of Google.
Yep.
Right? So, I mean, telling people what it is that you do and tapping into your own network, I mean, it's huge. And that's definitely something that we started doing now even more as we expand Prime Homes, and what we're trying to do now with longer-term holds and everything is just tapping into our networks. People know who we are. They know what we do. I mean, we have our credibility already built. So, easy marketing at that point. So, all right. Mr. Andrew, any parting thoughts or
final comments?
Anything that you want to leave the people with?
Oh, boy. That's a lot of pressure.
The world. There are 7 billion people out there that could be listening right now. What do you
potentially
want to
potentially 7 billion listeners.
Leave them with a tip. Buy low, sell high.
Buy low, sell high. There's a tip. Always, yes. No, gosh. If there's one thing we've learned over the last couple of years, it's just get your own ducks in a row before you out and try to do this. A guru's not going to be able to sell you a house with no money down and lead you to be successful if you don't have the potential to be successful. So just take your time, figure your stuff out. But at the same point in time, put yourself out there. Be in the network. Be in the environment that stuff's actually happening. And it'll happen for you too.
Very nice. Very nice. All right, guys. Appreciate you guys listening like always. If you find anything valuable, just comment, share. Let us know what you want to hear, what questions you have. If there's anything that, you know, didn't make sense to you in this, just make sure to write it in. We're everywhere on social media. Just let us know and we'll address it on the next podcast. So again, thank you so much for listening to the podcast and hope you guys learned something. See you on the next one.